Hello and welcome to the Neshama Project podcast, where we explore spiritual tools for human thriving. I'm Rabbi Ben Newman. Today I have a special episode where I go back into my own history about 20 years when I was living in New York City and finishing up rabbinical school and studying for my doctorate at the Jewish Theological Seminary in Manhattan. I was studying Jewish magic at the time. And I was frequenting Eilat Chaim, the Jewish Renewal Retreat Center that was in upstate New York. And one of the people I met was a man named Moshe Lev Greenblatt, also known as Robert Greenblatt, and we became friends. He was a chassid, a student of Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi. He was an anti-war activist, also a Holocaust survivor from Hungary. He spoke with a Yiddish accent. He smoked cigarettes and drank scotch, which we did together. And we played Go. We used to play the Japanese game of Go together and have lots of very deep philosophical conversations about so many different topics. We often talked about the Bush administration and the Iraq War and all of the troubles we saw there. I happened to decide to interview him during that time. I brought my video camera and I videotaped him probably for several hours. And I happened to find the videotape of one of these sessions recently. And I went back and I realized that it would be a good thing to release on this podcast. So today I'm going to release the audio of an interview, about a half an hour, maybe 20 minute interview I did with Moshe Lev. And it was around, I'd say around 2003, 2004 that we did the interview. We sort of fell out of touch when I moved to Colorado in 2009. And he actually died shortly after, and I didn't find out about it until a number of months after he died, which was very upsetting to me to find out sort of after the fact. I also discovered a lot more about him after he passed away. He had told me that he had traveled to Hanoi with author Susan Sontag, and he had told me that he had been called before the House Un-American Activities Committee. I discovered a Wikipedia page for him where he was quite an activist against the Vietnam War. He was part of the National Mobilization Committee to End the War in Vietnam, and he even went to jail many times for his protesting of the war. You can check out his Wikipedia page. I'll put a link to it in the description of the podcast. Some great quotes from him in the Wikipedia page, and I'm sure there's other places that he's been quoted, but I don't think anybody has ever had an interview with him like this. I also have an old tape of his, videotape of him giving an interview about his experience in the Holocaust. I'll see if I can get that transferred to digital format eventually, and if I do, I'll hopefully be able to upload that to this podcast as well. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy this interview. It's sort of intense at moments, sort of jovial at moments. He was sort of a funny guy, and he had a very dark sense of humor, sort of like I do. And he talks a lot about early Jewish renewal and getting to meet Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi and some of the theological and philosophical struggles he had being a survivor of the Holocaust and coming to America and feeling like God had abandoned him and his family. So you'll listen and you'll hear what he has to say. And maybe he'll inspire you a little bit. Maybe you'll relate to his struggles and learn something new. With that, I'm going to turn it over to my 20-year-ago self and Moshe Lev.
The story about the Nigun, Reb Zalman.
About the single back.
I'm sure there's a lot of background to it.
I first met Reb Zalman in winter, December of 1955. It was my freshman year in college, in Brooklyn College. I was just out of yeshiva. I was still quite orthodox. I still tried to learn. I still tried to have a seder or two. But I also had, and I was very, very impressed with myself that I was going to the university, right? You gotta understand, I landed in this country, I was 10 and a half years old, and I had at that point in my life spent maybe 3 weeks in school, but not at any one time.
Wow.
And I started in the eighth grade, Hill Shuk. Now when I landed, I did speak Yiddish, German, Hungarian, Hebrew, Polish, and Russian. But it was a time when nothing in this culture supported being multilingual. So I lost the Polish and Russian completely because I was not literate in those two languages. The others I could read and write. So I managed to retain semblances of it. And I had a good background in mathematics because in the DP camps during the war, I mean, after the war, actually even during the war, but let's not go there. Not tonight. My mother was always getting us tutors. So for my sisters, it was tutors in English because we were coming to America. I have no interest in being tutored in English. So she got me a guy who tutored me and was teaching me piano, which I loved. And also he was an older man and a kind man, and I had been without a father for all these years, so I had a father figure, right? And it turned out that he had been a commie, he had been locked up by the Nazis. He was not Jewish, he was a Czech. But he was also a civil engineer, and he had been a civil engineer and a concert pianist. So now he was teaching me, he'd give me a piano lessons once a week. And then, 4 days a week. And then my mother prevailed on him to actually give me math lessons, which he did once a week, for which she paid him a dollar, an American dollar, a month.
Wow.
Okay.
And this was good pay for it.
This was good pay, which our family would send us, snuck into the cardboard of the care packages. Because it was illegal to export dollars. That's another mice. So I started school at the age of, so now here I'm in the university. And when I say impressed with myself, I don't mean full of myself. I mean, hey, wow. there was a certain culture shock, because when I came here, I started eighth grade, I was in yeshiva, and I was yeshiva, and I loved being a yeshiva. In fact, I graduated high school a half year early, that is the English part, a half year early, so that, like in January, February, instead of so that I could spend full time, three shiurim, living in a dormitory to get really, you know.
To learn Talmud to.
Before I had to start going to college.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew, and I had every intention of going for smicha, but I knew that I didn't want to make a living as a Rebbe or a Rav.
Mm-hmm.
I was very into science, and I wanted to be a nuclear chemist, I think. I said. Other mices. Anyway, so here I am now in the fall, and I'm now in a whole different milieu. And
mm-hmm.
My whole background, I'm told them, was Shoah, DP camp, Orthodox Yeshiva, Chaim Berlin, Bouncer. And now I'm in Brooklyn College. And for one thing, as the 2,000-year-old man used to say, hey, there's ladies here. Right?
Uh-huh.
But there's also apikursus here. There's, you know.
Right. The whole wise.
And wow. And I was very, very cerebral. I was very intellectual. For whatever reasons, I'm not going to get psychological right now, but I'll just tell you, my state of mind was, I was very proud of the fact and used to announce at any opportunity, I am in total control of my emotions. It's only the intellect.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because this is a literature yeshiva.
Right.
I mean, I had some chassidus in me from earlier years, but I had become, a
intellectualist, with wing, yeah.
I became a just as I was leaving, actually, the Rosh Yeshiva, my Litvak Rosh Yeshiva became a chassid. But that's another thing, because it turns out, Rav Isaac Kuttner, the last Shavuos I spent in 55 at Chaim Berlin was the first time he came down wearing a gartel. And within a year after that, all of his older bofrim had bod and payas, had beards and payas, where only one or two had before.
Wow.
Okay. He gave out Chaim that night. They didn't know what the hell it was. Chassidim, his students, and what it was.
Uh-huh.
I remember that night. What incredible. So, a lot of confusion. I'm in Hillel. I'm making some friends there. Hillel is being run by two, quote, modern Orthodox rabbis.
One of which is the one that you mentioned before.
Right. He's the senior one. He's the metropolitan director. And I consider him my first meeting with him. We later became very good friends, let me say it first. But when I first met him, I considered him a total sleazeball. You know, like a shyster lawyer.
Huh?
Everything was just too smooth.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. His hair was too slick, his tie was too straight, his answers were too...
He was too perfect, too
right.
Set up.
Right.
Yeah.
In fact, I'll tell you first, what turned that around? It was 1956. I started to, we'll have to come back, but 56. Hungarian uprising. Suddenly there's this whole deluge of, quote, Hungarian freedom fighters and Jewish freedom fighters who were escaping from Hungary after the Hungarian Revolution against the Soviet Union was put down.
Mm-hmm.
Rather harshly. And I'm sure other institutions were asked to, you know, provide support. They spent for. I was totally opposed.
Hey.
I felt that Hungarian freedom fighters who were coming to the United States were freedom fighters in the sense that they would fight freedom every place it raised its ugly head.
Uh-huh.
They were perfectly good Stalinists until 55.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because they lost, and now they suddenly became freedom fighters. They were opportunists, as far as I was concerned. And especially the Jews. Many of us who survived, not many of us survived, but of those that survived, many went back after war to see if there was any pieces of the shambles of their life in Mishpacha they could find. We went back because we got separated from my brother. My mother was convinced that my brother was still alive, and he wouldn't know what to do except to come home, so we have to go home and be there when he gets there. Everybody else thought she was demented. As usual, she was right.
He went home.
We went home, he survived.
And he went home.
And he went home, and we found him, and then we managed to get out again. Which was illegal, but she organized it, I mean. So you got the picture.
Okay.
Now, Hillel was the major single organization on campus. There were other organizations that were perhaps bigger in membership, but they were coalitions, like all the fraternities together would be bigger than Hillel. But no, what? Right. There was also something called the Housing Plan Association, which is like a secular, non-Greek fraternity.
Okay.
So there was Alan Dershowitz was head of the Housing Plan Association.
Okay.
At the time. Okay. We're the same year. Hillel had a student council which would meet Friday afternoons, and we would always end in time so that everybody could get home in time for Shabbos, you know. And I wound up being on the student council representing some committee or something or other. And the issue came up because we were asked by there was an interreligious coordinating committee of the college under the Dean of Students or Dean of Student Life. Numa Society, you know, for the Catholics or something. And all of us are being asked to try to raise money and support and figure out then some things we could do to help support these.
Freedom Fighters.
The Freedom Fighters coming, right. And I made a personal vow that I'm not going to participate in the debate. I knew how I felt. But I also felt that given my background, and given that everybody knew my background, it would be unfair for me to bias them, because if I spoke, I would probably guilt trip them.
Right.
How could they oppose me, right? So I made a personal vow. I'm going to vote against the proposition, but I'm not going to say anything until there's a vote. And I'm listening to the debate. And I find a number of the students are asking what I would consider the right questions. Not well enough informed, but they clearly had some questions. And the rabbi, the metropolitan director, sat in on the meetings, as he always did. And at one point he asked for the floor, and of course he was given the floor. And he didn't participate in the debate. He, in effect, gave a sermon. He, in effect, gave a sermon, the bottom line of which was that, in effect, you have no choice. It is immoral to vote against this proposition.
Huh.
And he was using his talent, and that certainly I felt that is guile, and his manipulative skill to finesse the issue. And when he finished, I asked for the floor. And I began by saying I wasn't going to participate in this debate. And here's why I wasn't going to participate in this debate. And here's why I now feel I have to. And I blew him away. I namish blew him away. When I was done, the vote was called.
What did you say?
I'm not sure I want to get into that, but I basically said, look, these are motherfucking Stalinists and opportunists who could have and should have gotten out, and they didn't because they thought they could make it better there. And now, having had the rug pulled out from under them, they're crying to us. Right? And those of them who are good at it probably have more money out of the country already than most of you sitting around this table.
Yeah.
And You, Rebbe, using your position to manipulate young people is outrageous.
Wow.
That's in effect what I said.
And you blew him out of the water.
Yeah. Nobody wrote a position. It was unanimously turned down. Good. Me and Gens. About 5-10 minutes later, one of the secretaries comes and tells me that Rabbi wants to see me in this study here. And okay, so I'm expecting a Bubaha come into the study. I sit down. And he apologized.
Yeah.
He absolutely acknowledged. No ifs, ands, or buts. We became friends for many years.
Yeah.
I used to babysit his children. I was at the reunion when he was making Aliyah.
Yeah.
Huh?
Right.
He apologized. He was wrong. He realized he was wrong. He got carried away by the emotions of the issue without thinking it through. And we were, not that we were never antagonists again.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We certainly were. He supported the war in Vietnam. I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Footnote here just came to me. Arlene and I organized the second event ever called the Shabbaton in the world. Zalman organized the first Shabbaton. We heard about it, and we organized the next one at Brooklyn College Hillel.
Yeah.
And we spent with sleeping bags. We spent 28 hours in the Hillel building for Shabbos with guest speakers and learning and davening.
Okay.
Anyhow, getting back to Zalman. So in that winter, I got selected, but we had these retreats called Winter Institutes, which were regional, that is, the metropolitan area, all the hillels, and you couldn't just sign up because, you know, it was limited to 100 people or 120 people or whatever. So each hillel was allocated a certain number of spots. Then each hillel made its selections in its own way. And we'd rent a kohalein, a bungalow colony, in the Catskills, because in the winter they had no business anyway. And we would go up there and from Friday mid-afternoon to Sunday mid-afternoon. And there'd be a curriculum, and all the hell. The rabbis would be there, and maybe a couple of other resources, you know, faculty. And on that one, the theme was Shabbos, Shabbat. Remember, that's when I first, that's when I first read Heschel.
Yeah.
That's when I first read that article I mentioned to you about Edward Armour about Sabbath, because it was on that reading list.
Uh-huh.
And it was, I remember it was from the Reader's Digest. I still have to find that. It's a lovely, lovely, lovely article. And Zalman had just been, he was still Lubavitch, and he had just been appointed Hillel Rabbi in Canada, Manitoba, University of Manitoba, I think. In fact, it was my rabbi from Brooklyn College who helped him get that job, which I didn't know until years later. And there was a man, I thought of him in years, Rabbi Oli, can't think of his first name, the first rabbi I ever met who was a true Talmud Chochem and Apikoy.
Yeah.
He was the head of the Hillel at Princeton. Smallish man, bald, white hair, spoke a dozen languages, including Aramaic, Assyrian, Greek, Latin, right? He could get up, and he did. He could get up impromptu and give a 2-hour lecture and quote sources in the native language. Levy, Irwin Levy.
Okay.
Irwin Levy. Technically, he was reformed. Actually, I think it was not, because I wanted to sit at his feet for a year. It was a total intellect. Total intellect.
Yeah.
And Zaman. Those are the two that made the impression.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that happened was on Friday night, after we had services and dinner, and Zalman gave a half-hour talk on the proper way of saying good Shabbos. Actually, it was a workshop more than a talk.
Mm-hmm.
And that Shabbos at the Suda at lunch, I asked him if I could speak to him for a few minutes. I said, sure, so we made an appointment for later in the afternoon. And I don't know if I mentioned this to you before, but the Gemara Metzia, Yochol Adam Shaleni.
Yeah, you should mention it on the tape, though. Important to the story.
So that was the topic of the conversation, how we went to our side. And because I felt, I just got the vibes from him on Friday night that I'd never met her ever before that I could ask this kind of question of.
Uh-huh.
You know? Because that wasn't a question of halacha, machlokes, how do you resolve this contradiction, or, you know, it was something that was very important to me, personally. And I was confessing something about myself by asking the question. So he asked me, okay, so what's your question? So there's a piece, there's an argument or a discussion.
Yeah.
It's about page 50 or 52, something like that, in, quote, the second gate in Bava Metzia, the Talmudic tractate of Bava Metzia, which I always refer to as, with its opening phrase, Yachol Adam Shalei, it would be better if the person, if a person,
humanity hadn't been
created.
Yeah.
But that's not where it starts. Where it starts is, there's a discussion, a difference of opinion that has to do with tort law, of all things. And has to do, under what circuit, has to do with shlifim, not messengers, but agents.
Mm-hmm.
That is, somebody's acting on your behalf in a legal sense, and usually you give him authority to do certain things on your behalf, and then blah, blah, blah. And then there are restrictions depending on how you define it. And so the question comes up, what if you act on my behalf on an issue that I didn't give you instruction? Can you legally bind me? And to oversimplify it, I mean, there's only, you know, we're going to do it now. If you want more, you can go to Bava Metzia.
Did Bava Metzia?
Yeah, it's Bava Metzia. Mm-hmm. Bava Metzia. 52 is what, right? 50, 51, 52, something. Okay. I know it's a Daf Beis.
Okay.
I know it's not.
You can probably picture it in your head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So essentially, the consensus seems to be in the discussion that if I haven't given you explicit instructions of authority, and you make an obligation on my behalf, if it is clearly in my benefit, it's legit. Doesn't mean I can't reject it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But if it's not clearly in my benefit, and certainly if it's clearly against my benefit, no, then you can't. I'm not obligated. Seems actually a reasonable enough, Adam. And the next question comes out of left field, or right field, or up above, or whatever, right? Just to get away from the two-dimensional.
The one-dimensional.
And there was this third type of logic.
But answers, well then, by what right did God create us? And so the other one says, Steich, what do you mean? Well, here we are. We're loaded with certain obligations. They're not easy. We wouldn't be here if he hadn't created us under these obligations. We weren't consulted. So the conversation devolves to the notion, well, it all comes down to one question. Are we better off having been created, or are we not better off having been created? If we are better off having been created, then he had the right to do it. If we are not better off having been created, then we don't have, then he didn't have the right. Mm-hmm. Now, before I tell you the conclusion, one of the, for me personally, the most galvanic importance of Talmudic tradition is the power to ask that question and to pose the alternatives in that way.
Perfect.
It says, B'nai B'ris, we're children of the covenant. A covenant is a two-sided contract. I've got obligations, but he has obligations.
Perfect.
And he can be the sole judge. Right?
Mm-hmm.
He may know more than me. That element, it's not the only element, but the presence of that element is the essence of free will. Hey. So the way the conversation in the Gemara concludes, remember the question was, if it's better that we were created, then he had a right to do it. If it's not better that we were created, then he didn't have the right to do it. And the Gemara concludes with, Yochel Adam Shalainu. Humanity would have been better off not having been created. And the discussion does not continue. Just stop there. The century says, now go think about it. And I look at Zalman. Reb Zalman. Now remember, at that time he was only 29, 30 years old, slightly chubby, with a scruffy beard, with a jacket that was a little too tight around the belly. You know. But the same gleam from his face, remember, the same gleam from his face, the same fire from his eyes, and the same Ahavas Yisroel, and Ahavas Olam, the same love of humanity was already glowing. If not, I couldn't have asked him the question. Mm-hmm. When I just met him the night before, clearly I had a question for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly I knew Weber, so I knew better. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And he taught me, man. I don't know if he taught me. He paused. And he said, the secret of Amunah, the secret of faith and belief, is that you have to begin by forgiving Kaviyachol for creating. You have to forgive God for creating.
Yeah.
There's no law that says you have to take that step. But now this is me interpreting. He didn't say the rest. He didn't say the rest, you know. But I don't, because if I misstate something now, I don't want to lay it on him.
Right.
So there's no chiyuv that you have to do that. On the other hand, you won't.
Right.
But if you can do that, then you've got a chance for emunah, for the connection. I don't know why this is intruding right now, but it does intrude, so I'm going to mention it. One of my more recent Lubavitch friends, a wonderful, wonderful man named Chaim Liebman, also somewhat a survivor of the Shoah, whom I've now known for a number of years, told me the following story that was told to him by Reb Menachem Mendel, the last Lubavitch Rebbe, at least according to me, not the Mashiach, just the last one. And, you know, there's an old saying, I think it comes from Pirkei Avos, but I'm not sure, that a ben tshuva is closer to God than a tzaddik. Now, there's a very derogatory explanation of that, which I love, but I'm not going to tell you. Break the mood, but which I learned from my father. So this is this was Reb Menachem Mendel's explanation of why that is. So imagine that we all are tied to Kaliyah. And make a physical image of that. There's not much, there's a cord. Like a rope. Right. Maybe it's an umbilical cord. Starts from you, goes up. What does it mean to stray? To go after the sitra? The cord got cut. You're disconnected. What is it to do? What does it mean to do tshuva? You have found the ends of the cords and you tied them back together with a knot. Now, first of all, the place where it broke, that knot is stronger than the rope was to make it. Because if you try to cut that again, you got more current than more layers. And number two, the rope is now shorter.
Right.
Right? Because you had to tie that. Get out. So that's from Rabbi Nachman Mendel via.
There are 2 minutes left on this job. It's Sydney, rather.
Fast forward. I'll skip a lot of stuff. And we'll have to clear it on our next tape if you've got one. But this is Reb Zalman now, with a little bit of Shoima, about 30 years later, 40 years later. Because for the next 15, 20 years, Zalman and I would still occasionally hook up. I got active in the anti-war movement, civil rights movement, blah, 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 totally secular. Always conscious of my Yiddishkeit, but not practicing anything. The only time I was ever in a shul or a synagogue was when there was a family event that required it, like somebody's wedding or somebody's bar mitzvah or an offer booth for something like that. Otherwise, no connection whatsoever. Which is not to say that, you know, I'm still culturally, I felt it. Even when I stopped observing kashrut, it was because I felt like I was being schizophrenic, and I needed to bring my life together. So, not justifying anything. But the other guy that I always also kept in contact with and occasionally crossed paths with was Reb Shlomo Kalba, who I actually met 2 years before Zalman when I was still in Yeshiva. And the two of them were the first two shluchim sent out by the early Lubavitch Rebbe. And what they wound up doing is exactly the shlichut for which they were set. And by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak.
That's it for my interview with Moshe Lev from 20 years ago. I hope you found something of meaning in it. It certainly still speaks to me after all of these years. I will add that Robert Greenblatt, also known as Moshe Lev, came back to his Yiddishkeit, his Judaism, in the form of Jewish renewal, and he was a frequent attendee of Eilat Chaim, Jewish Renewal Retreat Center in Northern New York. And he ended up, after he left his house in Brooklyn, where I did this interview, he ended up moving to Acord, New York, which is right near where Eilat Chaim is, and then subsequently, I think right before he moved, Eilat Chaim moved to the Isabella Friedman Retreat Center. And now I think all that's left of Eilat Chaim is a sign on the wall at Isabella Friedman that says Eilat Chaim. And Eilat Chaim really is no longer. But it was really an amazing place. It is where a lot of important things happen for me in my life, a lot of transformative experiences. That's it for this episode of the Neshama Project podcast. Until next time, this has been Rabbi Ben Newman. Take care and be well. Sei gesund.